a good problem to have, that we don't have a solidified opposition.
The strange politics of the minimum wage ballot initiative. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an airline pulls direct flights out of Fairbanks.
We're hearing balking from other airlines for sure, and you know, we are working with the airport and pitching new airlines.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This past legislative session, a bill that would have raised the minimum wage was among the most divisive items under consideration. Now, a citizens' initiative to do the exact same thing is about the least controversial question on this year's ballot. There's no spirited dissent to the proposition, and polls show the measure passing by a margin of 2-1. So why is that? APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez looks at how the minimum wage campaign found itself running without organized opposition.
Representative Andy Josephson vividly remembers testimony on the minimum wage bill. As a member of the Labor and Commerce Committee, he sat through the failed legislation's only hearing.
There was a packed room. There was a lot of media. There were no people testifying, with one exception that I recall, against the bill.
The one person who testified against raising the minimum wage was a bar owner from Nikiski, who argued it would burden her business.
There was no organized opposition from the business community, from the chamber, from the seafood industry, or from anywhere else.
In what might seem like a funny twist, Josephson ended up voting against the bill, even though he's now advocating for the wage increase. The whole story of the minimum wage bill actually involves a lot of strange bedfellows and accusations of political gamesmanship. The legislation was introduced by House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Republican from Nikiski. An initiative to raise the minimum wage to $9.75 over 2 years and then peg it to inflation had already been certified to appear on the ballot, and the language of the bill was identical. Initiative sponsors had two theories about this bill. The first worry was that legislators wanted to pass a minimum wage bill so they could go back and weaken it. If law is made by ballot initiative, legislators can't touch it for 2 years, but they can fiddle with it if they pass it themselves. Josephson points out that's exactly what happened a decade ago.
I believe the intent was what it was in 2003, and that was to pass a bill, and then at some later time, as soon as January 2015, to entertain a bill that would undo, essentially, and amend the existing bill.
The second theory was that Republicans didn't want the minimum wage question on the ballot because of the potential to draw out liberal-leaning voters. Meanwhile, Republicans accused Democrats and organized labor of wanting a minimum wage initiative on the ballot for exactly that reason. Regardless of the motives, the April fight over the bill has left the usual opponents of a minimum wage increase in an odd spot with the initiative. Denny DeWitt directs the National Federation of Independent Businesses Alaska chapter. They oppose a further increase to the minimum wage on the grounds that it could reduce employment opportunities, particularly for teenagers. Even though NFIB has been consistent with that position, DeWitt remembers the political overtones of the legislative debate, and he says responding to it posed a conundrum for his lobbying group.
You know, it's kind of a Gordian knot sort of thing, I guess.
In the end, NFIB did not take a position on the bill. Now they're raising their concerns at public forums, but have no plans to put money into fighting the measure.
We don't have the resources to do that. We're not a huge lobbying, well-heeled lobbying activity, as some are. So we do what we can.
The NFIB website boasts that Fortune magazine calls it the country's top business lobby, and the group has received backing from billionaires Charles and David Koch. The interplay between the bill and the initiative also has the Alaska Republican Party and some of its candidates straddling positions. Back during the legislative session, the party put out an action alert on Facebook, encouraging confused members to call their senators and ask them to pass the minimum wage bill. Now, party chair Peter Goldberg says there's no official position on the initiative. This all means initiative sponsors are mostly looking at lukewarm protests from interests who might normally fight them. This was clear at a recent Anchorage hearing where multiple pastors spoke in favor of the initiative and supporters waved signs outside the meeting at the Dena Center. On the anti-side, Denny DeWitt testified over the phone from the airport. A seafood lobbyist came out against it, and a representative from the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce offered his disapproval while noting that he didn't want to look like a villain. And that was it. Ari Gardner is the campaign director for Alaskans for a Fair Minimum Wage. He says there have been times when he's been invited to forums to speak on the initiative that he's had to help find someone, anyone, to do a counterpoint.
It's a good problem to have, that we don't have a solidified opposition, but it's still, I think we still have a lot of work to do.
Gardner says their goal isn't just to win, it's to secure a mandate. Even though the few polls that have been done on the measure show it clearing 60% of the vote, Gardner wants to guarantee as wide a margin as possible to discourage lawmakers from tampering with the minimum wage in the future.
It's important that people don't take for granted that this is going to pass.
So he says they're still planning on running hard, even though there's no one really running against them. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Community health centers in the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands will get at least $600,000 in federal grant money for new services this year. The grants are aimed in part at helping new patients who enrolled in health plans under the Affordable Care Act. But there aren't many of those in the Aleutian Islands. Instead, as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, providers will use the money for the patients they already have.
Jennifer Harrison oversees clinics from Whittier to Adak as executive director of the Eastern Aleutian Tribes. She estimates they only had about 11 patients sign up for new health plans on the federal marketplace.
They're probably people that were under the self-pay category and that have gotten insurance now. That would be my guess, because we've kind of already been seeing everybody in all of the communities. So I don't think that it's necessarily bringing in like a new person through the door. It's just helping that person pay for the services.
So Harrison's organization will use their $196,000 grant to contract with a traveling optometrist and physical therapist. They'll also set up a fund to pay to send people to residential drug and alcohol treatment centers, which right now Harrison says isn't happening.
It's really this weird gap in services throughout the state. It's not something that Indian Health Service really supports, like in a big way. And it's been really hard for people to get substance abuse treatment because often they don't have a job because of the substance abuse, so then they don't have insurance, so there's like nobody to help pay for it.
Most of Eastern Aleutian Tribes patients are insured by the Indian Health Service. EAT can make referrals for detox programs, but until now, they haven't been able to cover the program's costs. The federal grants will also pay for a mid-level provider on the Pribilof Island of St. George for the first time. The Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association is getting a $190,000 grant to help out the clinic there. Health Administrator Jessica Mataruka-Vishnikov also says the money will mainly serve current patients, though she does say most of St. George's 100 or so residents enrolled in federal health plans. APIA got another grant to make that happen. As enrollments go, though, Unalaska is the outlier in the region. The town's clinic didn't have any patients sign up for federal health care. Most of Illilook Family and Health Services clients use commercial insurance or pay out of pocket. Clinic Director Eileen Conlon-Scott says those patients haven't been able to enroll in federal health plans.
Well, if we could get them on the insurance rolls, our revenues would go up. But understandably, you know, they don't have $500 a month to pay on insurance.
So she says her clinic will use their federal grant like everyone else. They're getting between $200,000 and $400,000 to pay for new medical equipment and new visiting specialists. It'll mean more care for the people they're already treating, and for now, at the same price as before. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The manager of Alaska's infectious disease program says it wouldn't be surprising if an unusual respiratory illness that has affected children in the lower 48 is detected soon in Alaska. So far, Dr. Michael Cooper said Alaska has not had any confirmed cases of enterovirus 68. The virus can cause mild to severe illness, with the worst cases needing life support for breathing difficulties. Kids with asthma have been especially vulnerable. The State Health Department says infection occurs through close contact with someone who is infected or by touching one's mouth, eyes, or nose after touching a contaminated surface. The department says there are no specific antiviral medications for the illness. To guard against respiratory illnesses, the department recommends good hygiene and getting a flu shot in early fall. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, as the cruise ship season ends, a look ahead to future years.
It's staggering the number of people who will be in the economic strata in China in the next 10 years to afford cruises.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson project, proving energy lives here. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
A federal fisheries agency has raised concerns about the accuracy of some studies being conducted for a massive proposed dam in south central Alaska. In a letter to the project manager for the Susitna-Wautana Dam, the regional administrator of the National Marine Fisheries Service, James Balsiger, said new study requests can't be developed given the current problems with the data. Among other things, he questioned the accuracy of the identification of fish species. Project spokeswoman Emily Ford said overall, the Alaska Energy Authority, which is pursuing the project, is confident in the information it is gathering. She said the comments raised by agencies and others will be discussed during an upcoming round of technical meetings, at which the authority will also discuss its plans for next year. Two airlines that serve Fairbanks seasonally have made decisions that will decrease flights to the Golden Heart City. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, one is related to increased fuel cost.
Denver-based Frontier Airlines is pulling out of the Fairbanks market. Explore Fairbanks president and CEO Deb Hickok says the carrier, which has provided summer service to Fairbanks out of its Denver hub since 2010, decided to drop Fairbanks because of higher jet fuel prices that have resulted from closure of Flint Hills North Pole refinery this spring.
And their letter to the airport definitely said that the jet fuel was the cost of the jet fuel was a deciding factor.
Hickok says Frontier, which will continue to fly to Anchorage, has also been pressured by United, which came in to compete in the Fairbanks Denver market.
And so they shrunk their season in response to that. But then the straw that broke the camel's back was the increased cost of jet fuel because of the Flint Hills refinery.
Flint Hills is still selling jet fuel to airlines at Fairbanks International, but instead of locally produced product, the fuel is now trucked in from Anchorage. Hickok says the higher cost of that jet fuel is an issue for all airlines serving Fairbanks.
We're hearing balking from other airlines for sure, and you know we are working with the airport and pitching new airlines, and we actually have one in particular that I'm thinking of that's very interested, but you know, when they run their cost analysis, the cost of jet fuel is important to that.
Hickok won't say which airlines Explore Fairbanks is trying to woo here, but described the conversation with one as active. She says finding an airline to replace Frontier is a priority because competition helps keep ticket prices in check. Explore Fairbanks and airport officials are looking to PetroStar, which still operates a local refinery, to step in as an airport jet fuel supplier, as well as a legislative fix. On another front, Japan Airlines is halving the number of charter flights it flies to Alaska this winter. Hickok says the carrier is dropping the number of Alaska winter charters from last year's 18 to 9, but all will be to Fairbanks. Hickok describes the reduction as temporary as the airline incorporates new Boeing Dreamliner aircraft and trains pilots. She says this winter's JAL Fairbanks charters will also wrap up in early February, short of the popular March Fairbanks visitor season.
We're optimistic that they will sell March. It's just that the consumer will come to Fairbanks via the way they used to come before the direct charters, and that's they'll take flights from Asia to Seattle and you can come to Seattle Fairbanks.
Hickox says Fairbanks Area Lodges report they are booking blocks of rooms for March with Japanese tour operators. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska's cruise ship season ended last week. It and other types of tourism attracted a similar number of visitors as in 2013. But the next few years could be different, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Tourists off the Norwegian Sun find the last open excursion kiosk on Juneau's waterfront. They check out their options and arrange for a tour to the Mendenhall Glacier.
Is this one?
No, it'll be a van.
The Sun can carry up to 2,000 passengers plus 1,000 crew. Many times this summer, they've joined 10,000 or more other visitors and workers on Juneau's docks. But this day, it's the only ship in town, and the streets seem a bit empty. Convention and Visitors Bureau volunteer Sharon Meyer is one of the people answering tourists' questions. She helps them figure out what they can and can't do during their relatively short stays. And she hears some questions with pretty obvious answers.
How far are we above sea level? I'm not making that up. We get that all the time. And if we take American money.
If they're off a cruise ship, she'll politely remind them that it's floating in the ocean.
As far as the currency goes, you have to answer that based on who you're speaking with. You can never assume that they, you know, want a joke or something on their at their expense. So you just say, yes, we do it. But if you need an exchange, we can help them find a bank or someone that would help them out.
Juneau saw almost all of the cruise ship passengers sailing Alaska waters this summer. Skagway and Ketchikan saw a lot, and Sitka, Hoonah, Whittier, and Kodiak saw far fewer. John Binkley is the president of Cruise Lines International Association in Alaska.
It was a great season. We had almost a million visitors that will have come to Alaska on cruise ships, and about the same overall for other modes of transportation getting to Alaska. I think there were close to 2 million visitors this year.
2014 brought a new ship, the Crown Princess, which carries about 3,000 passengers and 1,200 crew. The same size Ruby Princess will sail next season, replacing a smaller ship. Cruise lines often shuffle vessels in and out of their Alaska routes. Binkley says that has advantages.
Many times when they put a new ship or a newer ship into a market, it has a loyal following, so you see a lot of passengers that want to go on the new ships and, of course, want to go to Alaska as well.
Passenger capacity has hovered around 1 million for several years. That may be as many as North American markets can provide. But Binkley says cruise lines are targeting new customers, especially in Asia.
It's staggering the number of people who will be in the economic strata in China in the next 10 years to afford cruises, and one of the top destinations that they want to cruise to is Alaska.
Absolutely. There's significant interest from China.
Jillian Simpson is Director of Membership and Tourism Policy for the Alaska Travel Industry Association.
And actually, already we're getting visitors from not only mainland China, but also people that are in the U.S., whether they're studying from China or they're over here for business, they're then adding on trips to Alaska.
Next year's season begins in early May when the Ruby Princess docks in Ketchikan. The ships will keep sailing till mid-September. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is considering an option to issue targeted hunting permits this winter to take moose that frequent roadways in the Fairbanks area. Don Young is the area management biologist.
There are problem moose in the Fairbanks area. You know, we consider them to be a problem moose, certainly if they're injured. And oftentimes when they're injured, they do become kind of aggressive in nature. And then, of course, those that are near the roads, if there's road projects and it's been planted with, let's say, ryegrass or whatever, you get moose that are hanging out by those roads and likely to get hit.
Fish and Game made a similar decision last year to alleviate moose-related traffic accidents in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley. The Board of Game established targeted hunts back in 2011 in order to help cut down on the cost of accident response from both state wildlife troopers and management biologists. Young says biologists believe a similar kind of hunt could help alleviate problems with moose in Fairbanks.
I wouldn't necessarily say that they're becoming an increasing problem. I would say that this was an idea that was brought forth by Fish and Game in South Central. And then we learned about that, of course, here in the interior and thought, we could use that similar approach here in the interior in the Fairbanks area. And I thought that it would be pretty effective.
The Department of Fish and Game could issue anywhere from one to a dozen permits, but managers are still considering options. Last year, Fish and Game did respond to injured moose, but this is the first time Fish and Game would allow targeted hunts in the region.
We've made a decision in that we are going to accept applications and we're going to develop a list or a roster, if you will, and that we won't make decisions on a targeted moose until later in the winter, and we'll see what happens in terms of the situation.
If the hunts do move forward, only shotguns with slugs or bows and arrows can be used to cull a problem moose. The application period opens today and runs through the end of October. Hunters will be assigned permits for a particular moose on a case-by-case basis. The department may also consider issuing permits for hunts on private property following consultation with the landowner. A group of health policy innovators gathered at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage this morning to talk about how Alaska's healthcare systems have evolved. The event is part of the Alaska Healthcare Commission's initiative to look at how Alaskans' health status has improved in the last 60 years. A lot has changed in that time, including the development of an independent tribal health system. Paul Sherry was a part of that development, first with the Tanana Chiefs Conference, and then with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, where he was CEO until 2008. Sherry says in the 50s and 60s, healthcare leaders were focused on designing a healthcare system that worked for the unique aspects of Alaska.
People gave a lot of examples of how the different elements of our system worked together to bring forward new solutions to problems like infectious disease and clinical care access and behavioral health, and I think a lot of the programs that you see in place today are a result of hard work and strategic planning back 20 and 30 years ago. So that's what we were focusing on, was the background of that.
And in that context, how much have Alaska's health systems changed in the last 60 years?
Well, let's say at least 50 years. I think we moved from a time when infectious disease was the major health issue in the state. And since that time, with all the improvements in immunizations delivery and better water systems and housing conditions, you know, we don't see infectious disease at the levels they were 50 years ago. Today, Alaska enjoys a substantially higher level of clinical care access than 40 years ago. The ability to get to see a trained clinical provider, whether that's a community health aide or a mid-level practitioner or a specialist, now in the state, changed dramatically over the last 40 years. And then I think more recently, you know, we've shifted to where the health status challenges for Alaska are really behavioral. They are about drinking and eating too much unhealthy food and smoking and all the behaviors that are going to cause big new problems for Alaskans in the next 20 years. So it's kind of like, well, how do we continue to bring that innovation so that we can address those kind of problems, which are in many ways much more difficult to solve than infectious disease?
You, Mr. Sherry, have had a long tenure in the healthcare field and in management of it. What was your own role in developing the Native-owned health system in Alaska?
Well, I had the pleasure of working for 20 years with Tananaw Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks, became their healthcare administrator. In the second part of my life, I guess I've worked more on the statewide level. It was a big challenge to develop the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and I had the opportunity to be their CEO for the first 10 years.
How difficult was it to make the transition from federal control to tribal control of Native health care?
Well, you know, one of the biggest changes in Alaska's health care in the last 40 years has been that the Native communities taken on its own responsibility for health care for themselves. And, you know, that it's a process that the Alaska Federation of Natives called for back in 1975. They wanted to see it happen in 10 years, and it ended up taking 25 years really to be fully realized. But so we've had a major shift in a very large sector of the Alaska health system. It took a long time because people needed to be organized, people needed to develop the organizational capacity, and do the strategy work that was necessary. But I think Alaska can be proud that it has one of the most comprehensive Native-owned healthcare systems in America. So that's been a really encouraging thing to see happen.
Paul Sherry was CEO of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Didn't quite catch that report. Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.